Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Well, dear people, as promised, when we said we're going to transition to the third hour, we're bringing, and we have, and we got the old bitter ender, and he also doubles as a professor. He most certainly does. I can't think of anybody any better. He's taught me more. I wish I could remember better, but he's taught me more about history, especially the history 1850s, 1870s, during that Lincoln's War. Matter of fact, I hadn't told the bitter ender this, but I've been going back. I use the Creature from Jekyll Island kind of as a reference Bible, specifically with the economics. Was there a whole section there in the Creature from Jekyll Island where G.W. Griffin talks about the real causes of Lincoln's War? And I'd like to say, you know, the bitter ender should be proud, because this guy, he knows what he talks about. He's supposed to be, he's looked up real high esteem. He said the same thing the bitter ender had said. You know, if you're thinking the war was started over slavery, I mean, just you're just dreaming. And that, you know what, those rich New Englanders, they didn't give a hoot in hell about those barefoot darkies. They didn't give a damn. They wouldn't care if they made it through the damn night. If they died during the night, it was all economics. But anyway, G.W. Griffin pointed that out and went pretty into heavy in the detail in it. Anyway, as promised, we got the bitter ender himself on. So with that, I'm going to shut my mouth and get out of sight and let the professor take it over. I told the professor, I don't know how many dunce caps you brought with you, but I told the people if they were late, you would make them wear a damn dunce cap. So go ahead, professor.
They're all mine that I've had to wear down through the years, so we just pass them on. You know, it's interesting you brought that up about money and not slavery as a cause of the war. We were talking about books a couple of weeks ago, some good books for people to read to get the factual history on the war in the South and see. And one we didn't have a chance to get to, ran out of time, was a book by Charles Adams. It was called When in the Course of Human Events, Arguing the Case for Southern Secession. And Charles Adams is a Northerner. And I think he was going to write the obligatory slavery book on the war. And once he got into it and started studying something about it, he goes, whoa, wait a minute. It wasn't about slavery. It was about money. And he goes through all of the things that Lincoln said about losing the tariffs that the South was paying, because the South was paying a lot more tariffs than the North was. The New Englanders got Congress to pass a bunch of tariffs against goods coming in from England and Europe, because the Southerners were trading cotton for the manufactured goods, and they wanted high tariffs to force the Southerners to buy all their manufactured goods from New England. And so that's what they did. And they're whining and crying about, oh, Trump's going to put a 25% tariff on this and a 10% tariff. The Morrell tariff that they passed was 40%. So that was a killer to the South as far as being able to trade the cotton to England and France and these other countries in Europe. So, yeah, he goes through a lot of that. And Lincoln said, you know, the Southern states can stay out of the Union. They can keep their slaves as long as they pay their taxes to the federal government. And, you know, and that's why he moved the troops from Fort Moultrie on the north side of Charleston Harbor out to Fort Sumter. There weren't any Yankee troops at Fort Sumter. There's a construction crew and a lighthouse keeper. Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor was under construction. So he moved the troops out there, which effectively blocked the harbor of any ships coming into Charleston. And then that's when he said, you know, as long as they pay their taxes to the U.S., then they can keep their slaves and stay out of the Union. So I've always used the analogy today, well, the South, you know, then they opened fire on the ships that were coming in the next day and on Fort Sumter. Well, of course they did. Their country was invaded by a foreign country. So what if the Russians or the Chinese communists put a missile battery at the Verrazano Narrows coming into New York Harbor and said, okay, ships can come into New York. We're not going to stop them from trading with New York and the United States, but they're going to have to stop at the Narrows there and pay a high tax to Russia and to communist China or Iran or North Korea before they can enter the United States. Now, how long do you think that would last? So anyway, that's something we just thought we'd throw out since you started mentioning that, and I thought that was a good thing to bring up. Our subject for today, for March, is, well, actually two great birthdays in the month of March. The first being Patrick Ronayne Claibert, who was born in County Cork, Ireland, March the 16th, tomorrow, March the 16th, 1828, General Pat. And, of course, the other famous birthday in March is the Bitter Ender. We all know, I don't know
that's
why
right.
that's not a,
that's
national,
right.
a national holiday. And March the 2nd, 1946, a date that will live in infamy. So, yeah, well, we'll skip over that one for now and get back to General Claibert. You know, like we said, March the 16th, 1828, his father was a doctor. And he wanted his son to follow in his footsteps in the medical field. And Patrick was went through several schools, private schools there, and academies and so forth. But he failed the medical exam due to his lack of proficiency in Latin. And he was so embarrassed that he pretty much ran away and joined the British Army, the 41st Regiment of Foot. And it didn't take him long to figure out he made a bad mistake. The British Army back then, well, a lot of the Europeans were extremely brutal to the enlisted men. And you got went into the Army if you really couldn't do anything else. It was a pretty brutal existence. And the officers were like, you know, medieval landowners or kings or royalty. And the enlisted men were just dirt under their feet. So after 3 years, he finally, with some help from his family, had enough money to purchase his discharge. And then he, his brother, and sister immigrated to the United States in 1849. They came in through the port of New Orleans, and he and his brother and sister went upriver to Cincinnati. And Patrick worked in a pharmacy there, and he had worked in a pharmacy back in Ireland. But he just didn't know enough to pass the medical exam to get into medical school. So he knew what he was doing, worked in a pharmacy, just like he had done in Ireland. And then he got a job offer from a friend and moved to Helena, Arkansas, where he also worked in a pharmacy there and where he earned a law degree. And he became one of the most well-respected men in Helena, Arkansas, and one of the most eligible bachelors in Helena. Now, when the war clouds began to spread over the South, I wanted to read a couple of quotes that came from Claiborne, and this is one of them. Hold on just 1 second here, make sure this thing doesn't run away with me. He says, "I am with the South in life or in death, in victory or defeat. I never owned a Negro and care nothing for them. But these people, the fellow Arkansans, have been my friends and have stood with me on all occasions. In addition to this, I believe the North is about to wage a brutal and unholy war on a people who have done them no wrong in violation of the Constitution and the fundamental principles of the government. They no longer acknowledge that all government derives its validity from the consent of the government. They are about to invade our peaceful homes, destroy our property, and inaugurate a servile insurrection, murder our men, and dishonor our women. We propose no invasion of their country, and we have nothing to gain from that." So this was what his feelings were, and then the end of that quotation was, we plan no attack on them and only ask to be let alone. And that's pretty much what Jefferson Davis said. We seek no conquest nor aggrandizement. All that we ask is that we be left alone. Of course, that wasn't about to happen. Lincoln was not going to allow the money market, the cash cow, the goose that was laying his golden eggs for keeping up the federal government, to leave the Union. They were going to be forced in at gunpoint if necessary. And Lincoln even admitted he needed an incident to provoke the South to fire the first shot. So then he could claim, oh, the beautiful stars and stripes have been fired on. We have to have 75,000 volunteers from state militias, the states that are still in the Union, to invade this country and force them back into the Union. And people always saying, well, you're so critical of the United States. Why don't you just leave? Why don't you just leave if you don't like it? I said, well, you didn't pay much attention in history class, did you? We tried to leave for 4 years, and we killed 380,000 of you people from the North and probably maimed and crippled another 100,000. He put a gun to the head of that president and blew his brains out all over his crazy old lady. If that's not trying to leave, what is it? So you're forcing us to stay. So anyway, got off on a little political rant there. We'll get back to the biography of General Patrick Claiborne and right after the break.
Yes, sir. Well, I'm really waiting on. Be right back, folks.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
Blood River Radio family. Without further ado, because this time is money, and it just flies by. We're going to go right back to the professor himself, Professor Bitter Ender. You do not want to be ready for class. You know what? Sometimes he gets so pissed off, he stops handing out dunce caps and just cuts your head off. Well, he got these swords, you know. He don't care for nothing.
Hey, no. That cuts down on the size of the class. You do something like that.
You know, on second thought, maybe the Bitter Ender will have mercy on you and just make you wear a dunce cap if you're late. So go ahead, Bitter Ender.
No, we were talking about one of my real heroes during our war for Southern independence was Patrick Ronayne Claiborne. And in Ireland, it's spelled C-L-E-B-U-R-N-E, and it's Claiborne, Texas, because a lot of his men after the war settled out there, and they named this little town where they were living Claiborne. But the Irish pronunciation is Claiborne, like it was C-L-A-Y. So most of the historians call it Claiborne, and it's still Claiborne, Texas. So I wouldn't go out and mess with those Texicans and tell them they got the wrong name.
No,
that's not a good idea. So anyway, we're talking about feelings that Claiborne had about the South and about living in Arkansas and the fellow people there in Arkansas that were his friends. And that quote that we gave before the break was from a letter he wrote to his brother talking about, these people have stood beside me and I care nothing for the Negro, don't want to own any. He felt that his country, his adopted country, was about to be invaded. And this was an interesting thing to Claiborne. during the war and before it, and talking about why he was taking his side with the Confederacy, he saw the South in the same situation that Ireland was in. Ireland was under the heel of the British Empire. And they talk about all of these potato famines and the famines and things that hit Ireland and how many of them starved and people were just so desperate they were crawling along on their hands and knees and eating grass. And, of course, you vomit that up. Humans can't absorb that. And so many of them came to this country to avoid starvation. Well, the reason was the British were loading up ships and taking all the farm goods from Ireland across to England. And it wasn't just that the crops failed in Ireland. The British were taking all of it. So he saw the South as the Irish fighting against the British. And he saw the South as the Irish were, but fighting against the Yankee Empire. And the Yankee Empire robbing the South and taking everything that we had. So he was, of course, very sympathetic to the Southern cause. So anyway, he was very well thought of there in Helena. He was elected captain of the local militia company. And with his experience in the British Army, he advanced to the rank of colonel of the 15th Arkansas Regiment. And the British taught him how not to treat enlisted men and not to be a cruel tyrant. And his men respected and loved him, and they had unswerving loyalty to him. And he rose to the rank of a brigadier general, brigade commander in 1862 in William Hardy's division. Now, his first battle was at Shiloh, down on the Tennessee River at Pittsburgh Landing in April of 1862. And Claiborne's brigade stormed through the Yankee camps and drove the Federals back to the Tennessee River. Grant had his army there, and Albert Sidney Johnston marched the Confederate Army through rain and mud up from Corinth, Mississippi. They were within about 100 yards of the Federal Army, and Grant had no idea that an enemy's army of over 40,000 was that close to his lines. And so he was caught completely by surprise on that first morning. And, of course, Claiborne's division was one that just ripped right through, or brigade. He wasn't a division commander yet. Brigade that just ripped right through the camps and drove them back to toward the river. Of course, that night, Grant's army was reinforced by Buell's troops, and they outnumbered the Confederates the next day and began to force the Confederate army from the field. And they retreated, but then it was up to Claiborne to lead a counterattack that stopped the Union pursuit. And then also it was stopped by somebody we've talked about before, a cavalry commander by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest. The next big military operation that Claiborne was involved in was Bragg's Kentucky invasion, where they marched from Corinth all the way up through Middle Tennessee up into Kentucky, almost all the way up to Louisville, and then fought the battle at Perryville. Now, while the fighting with the Army of Tennessee was going on at Perryville over in eastern Kentucky, just before that, Claiborne had been sent up through Knoxville and Cumberland Gap with Edmund Kirby Smith, and they routed the Federal Army at Richmond, Kentucky. It was a complete rout, and many of them, the Federals, were captured, killed, and really just tore off away from that battlefield as fast as they could go. But Claiborne, it was one of the worst defeats the Union Army ever suffered during the war. But Claiborne was right up close to the front lines. He was shot through the cheek, and he lost three or four teeth, and he was scarred forever with that wound or that bullet going through him. And that's why he grew a beard to try to cover that up. But with all of that, he just packed his mouth full of cloth to try to stop the bleeding and stayed on the field until the Federals were driven off in just total disorder. He returned to Middle Tennessee and with the rest of the Army of Tennessee in Middle Tennessee area after Bragg's invasion of Kentucky. And President Jefferson Davis was visiting the Confederate camp at College Grove, Tennessee, and commissioned Patrick Claiborne, then a brigadier general, promoted him to major general. 3 weeks later, Claiborne was in the Battle of Murfreesboro, and it was Claiborne's division now. He'd been moved up to a major general and division commander that spearheaded the Confederate attack and drove the Federal Army back into a really sharp V, and they were pinned up against Stones River. Bragg could not figure out how to finish the battle. Bragg was really good, and I'll give him credit in some areas, but a lot of people said he was the best general the Yankees had. But anyway, he was good at organizing troops and training them, and he usually had a good battle plan. But once that first shot was fired, his battle plan just dissolved. He didn't have the ability to adjust to what was happening out on the field. And I think that was one reason that Bedford Forrest was so good. Yes, he had battle plans. Yes, he could march behind the enemy lines. He could send out scouts and things and make the Federals think he was at five or six different places at once. But once the fighting started, he was there. And he could see what was going on. He could get – it's kind of like a head coach being on the sideline instead of sitting up in the press box. You're down there with the troops. You can tell if they're getting nervous and about the line is about to break, or if you just push them a little harder and encourage them, they can finish off the enemy. But that's something Bragg couldn't do. And once the battle started, if it didn't go exactly the way it had it written out on his battle orders, he just kind of went into a mind state of not being able to adjust. And the same thing happened at Murfreesboro. They drove attack caught them off guard again that morning, Rosecrans Federal Army there at Murfreesboro, and they just swept them back and up against the Stones River and almost had them finished off. And then Bragg couldn't figure out how to finish the battle. And the next day they did nothing on January 2nd. The first day's fighting happened on December 31st, 1862, and then the next day's battle on January 2nd, 1863, and Bragg couldn't figure out how to do it, and he took a lot of losses, and he retreated, and that began what was known as the Tullahoma Campaign. Buell, whose command of the army then was replaced by William Rosecrans, and he started a campaign against the Confederate Army to force the army out of Tennessee, and they pretty much did that. They went from Murfreesboro all the way down to Chattanooga basically without firing much of a shot at all, except there were two major battles right at the start of it when the Federal Army came out of Murfreesboro, one at Hoover's Gap and one at Liberty Gap. And Liberty Gap near War Trace was being held by Claiborne's division, and the Federal Army had absolutely no success in trying to break through that gap in the hills. And they did get through a few miles over to the east at Hoover's Gap, and now the Yankees were behind the Confederate line, so the whole line had to fall back. The next big battle that Claiborne was in was at Chickamauga in September of 1863. he broke through the Federal lines under Rosecrans at a couple of points in the line and really threatened their whole line. And Rosecrans made the mistake of pulling a division out of the middle of the line to try to send them up to the north or to his left to stop Claiborne's division. I heard one historian talk about it. Claiborne division had a unique flag from when they came from General Hardee's corps. It was a blue flag with a white circle or a white oval. All the regiments in his command had that blue flag with the white circle or the white oval. And then they'd had their regimental number and their battle honors and so forth on that. But they said it was so distinctive from the regular Confederate flag, which is the red flag and the blue diagonal cross or St. Andrew's cross on there, that when Claiborne's division came on the field, every gun in the Federal line was turned on them because they knew how tough that bunch was. And said it did, but that didn't stop them. They still made the attack and drove the Federal lines back about 3 miles through the woods. Rosecrans was in a panic. He pulled a division out of the line from further south and sent them to the north. The only problem was they forgot to plug that gap. And it was about that time that James Longstreet, who'd come down from Virginia with Hood's division and McLaws, they went sailing right through that gap in the Federal lines and turned left and right. And Chickamauga was a rout for the Federal Army and would have been destroyed had it not been for George Thomas making the stand at Snodgrass Hill and saving what was left of the Federal Army so they could get over Missionary Ridge and get back down into Chattanooga. So Claiborne was very much a part of that. We'll continue the story of Irish-born General Patrick Claiborne in just a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
How How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Brutal weather in the middle of the nation. Twisters claiming the lives of at least 17 people, many of them in Missouri. Butler County Coroner Jim Akers says rescuers had to hike in for about a mile, clearing down trees and brush along the way to get to a victim and his wife.
The deputy and EMS hiked in. Other crews started clearing the road so that the ambulance could get in and get to the victim. They ended up, from what I understand, getting her stabilized and carrying her out quite a good ways before they were able to get to a vehicle.
Wildfires in Oklahoma. The governor says more than 200 homes have been destroyed or damaged. No fatalities, though, reported in the Sooner State. Also, at townhall.com, President Trump signing a major funding the government for 6 months, avoiding a shutdown.
The bill largely keeps government funding at levels set during the Biden administration, though with changes. It trims non-defense spending by about $13 billion from the previous year and increases defense spending by about $6 billion. The Senate cleared the legislation Friday in a 54-46 party line vote, with Democrats helping advance it despite saying they had problems with the bill. I'm Julie Walker.
El Salvador is agreeing to accept from the United States about 300 members of a Venezuelan gang for 1 year. The deal will cost the U.S. $6 million, about $20,000 per migrant who is sent to Central America. Transfer is one of the first under a deal between President Trump's administration and El Salvador to house migrants from the U.S. More on these stories, townhall.com.
Attention! If you owe money to the IRS, this is an urgent message. The IRS is cracking down by sending out collection letters, garnishing paychecks, seizing bank accounts, and putting liens on homes and businesses. They call it enforced compliance, and you better watch out, because penalties and interest on unpaid taxes compound daily, making it even harder to get out of debt. Don't let tax debt destroy your life. You need to call Optima Tax Relief, America's number one tax resolution firm. They're experts in taxpayer assistance programs that can save you thousands if you qualify. A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau, Optima's resolved over $1 billion of tax debt for their clients. Let them fight on your behalf, helping to put your tax problems to rest. Call the tax professionals at Optima now for a free consultation.
Call 800-965-1433. 800-965-1433. 800-965-1433.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand.
We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR's hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips anytime, anywhere. Join us at LibertyNewsRadio.com. Empower your day with the truth, because the truth will set you free. LibertyNewsRadio.com.
Being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Dear Blood River Radio family, we don't want to run out of time, and we don't want to cut the bitter ender short, so we're going right back to the bitter ender, talking about that wonderful... In fact, he might be my favorite. Of course, I guess everybody's favorite is Nathan Bedford Forrest. But I tell you what, Claiborne's nipping at his heels. But go ahead, Bitter Ender, continue on.
Yep. Well, I agree with you there. If they put Claiborne in command of the Army of Tennessee and some of the dim bulbs they had, might have been a whole different story in that war. And he yes. and Forrest got along. And Forrest didn't get along very well with a lot of people, especially these West Pointers that went out there and screwed everything up and wouldn't listen to advice from people that were out on the field. But I think he and Claiborne were really respected each other. So anyway, we're talking about Battle of Chickamauga in September of 1863 and the role that Claiborne's division played in that. And then, of course, the Union Army retreated back over into Missionary Ridge and into Chattanooga, and that's where Forrest was up on Missionary Ridge and captured that signal tower and was looking down there, and he was sending word back to Bragg, bring the army up, bring the army up. The Federals are disorganized, they're demoralized. And Bragg was sulking in his tent because his orders hadn't been followed out. Won a huge battle, but he wouldn't finish it off. And that's what infuriated Forrest and Claiborne, too. You know, they were ready to come over Missionary Ridge and just finish off the Federal Army. So Bragg, in a brilliant strategy, divided his army and decided to lay siege to Chattanooga and to Knoxville rather than bring this whole army together and take out Chattanooga and then go to Knoxville or vice versa. He split the army up and lost both of them. So in the winter of 1863, the Confederates took up positions on Lookout Mountain and Missionary Ridge, looking down in Chattanooga and trying to cut off the supplies, and they were going to try to starve Rosecrans' army out. Well, Rosecrans was relieved of command and replaced with Ulysses Grant and William Sherman. And then in the latter part of November 1863, they launched attacks against the Confederates on Lookout Mountain, and they captured Lookout Mountain, which opened up the supply line on the Tennessee River. And then 2 days later, they launched an attack on the remaining Confederate army on Missionary Ridge and broke through the lines right through the middle, and except for the northern end of Missionary Ridge. Now, that was held by Patrick Claiborne's division. And Sherman, William Sherman,
wow, what a shocker.
War is hell Sherman, I think this is where he figured out war was hell. He attacked Claiborne's division from sunup till almost sundown and never got a single soldier up to the top of Missionary Ridge. Patrick Claiborne's division beat back the Federal assaults time after time after time again. And one time they sent soldiers through a tunnel on Missionary Ridge, and they came out behind Sherman's attack, and they just did a right wheel and came sweeping up behind Sherman. All of a sudden, Sherman's men were getting shot from the top of the ridge where Claiborne's men were, and here came Confederates up behind them off the railroad track shooting at them. So he held on there even though the Confederate lines broke, and they retreated back down off of Missionary Ridge. And once again, it was Claiborne's division that was providing the rear guard. And the next day at Ringo Gap, if you're going down I-75 to Atlanta, you know, you come out of Chattanooga, and then right there, just as you leave Chattanooga, is Ringo Gap. And there's a big gap in the mountains there. And now it's the interstate goes right through there. It's not that hard to drive. But back then, the road kind of twisted and turned down at the bottom of this gap along this creek. So what Claiborne did, he set an ambush for him. He had his men up on these two high pieces of ground, looking right down on the gap, and they were concealed with trees and piled up brush and everything. And the Federals came storming after them. They even put an old broken down wagon down in the creek and had the team of horses unhitched. And these Confederates were acting like they had a log under the wagon, trying to pry it up and get it out of the creek. And they had two or three other wagons up at the top of the hill on the road and just sitting there. And when they saw the Yankees coming, they told those wagons to take off like that was the tail end of the wagon train. And these guys that were trying to get this broken down wagon out of the creek, they dropped everything they were trying to do, jumped on the mules and took off. Well, the Yankees just came pouring into this gap. They got, oh boy, we got them this time. We got them. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We got Br'er Rabbit this time. We're going to get him. Well, when they got into that gap, the whole side of both sides of that gap just exploded in sheets of canister from the cannons, rifle fire, and the federal pursuit of the Confederate Army was wiped out. That was the end of that. And after they got away and got down to Dalton, Georgia, and went into winter quarters, Patrick Cleburne was given a special thanks and commemoration from the Confederate Congress for saving the Army at Ringo Gap. Now, while they were in winter quarters, there were several things that happened that may have doomed Cleburne's career. First of all, he sent several things that he did. We'll get into that politics in just a little bit. He got about a dozen Whitworth sniper rifles from England, came through the blockade. Oh. And these rifles fired a hexagon-shaped bullet, and they had telescopic sights mounted on them. And he had a marksmanship contest in the division and picked out the 12 best shots in the division and gave them these sniper rifles. And they would put them out on the lines. If they were getting pounded with federal artillery, they would let these snipers pick off the federal gunners at 600-800 yards away, half a mile away. So now the Yankees had the choice of getting all their gunners killed or send out their infantry to try to chase away these snipers. And when they did, the rest of the Confederate infantry was waiting for them. They just mow them down, or they had to knock off their artillery fire and get their cannons out of there before they lost all of their gunners. So that was one thing he came up with. But another thing was that Cleburne was sort of a prophet, and he said, if we surrender, surrender means that the history of this war, of this heroic struggle, will be written by the enemy, that our youth will be trained by Northern school teachers, learned from Northern school books, their version of the war, and taught to regard our gallant dead as traitors and our maimed veterans as fit subjects of derision. So he was preaching to the South what exactly was going to happen if we lost this war. He had seen the bitterness that the Northerners had towards Southerners, and they were going to rewrite the history of the war to make even people in the South hate their soldiers and hate the attempted independence movement of Southern independence. And he was exactly right. That's what we've come to. And they've even made people in the South turn against our Confederate ancestors. So that was what he was warning about. He came up with a plan and sent a letter to President Davis to take the slaves into the Confederate Army. He said, we can never win a war of attrition. And said, we can win battles, but we can't replace our losses. And we need to have close to the manpower that the Federal Army has. He said, we could take the slaves, and if they served honorably through the end of the war, they would earn their freedom. And regardless of the outcome of the war, which is basically what Bedford Forrest told his slaves that he went with him, that went with him. And there weren't that many. There were only about 40-something that went with him as teamsters and harness makers and blacksmiths and so forth in his army. And he gave them the same deal. You serve through the war, you'll get your freedom regardless of the outcome of the war. And Cleburne was saying basically the same thing on a much larger scale. Well, that idea just bombed. It went over like the screen door in the submarine. And he was pretty much told, don't ever bring that up again. Now, the Confederacy, and Davis tried it a year or so later toward the end of the war, and it was too little too late. But Cleburne's own idea was we could free the slaves under our own terms, and we wouldn't have to worry about and win our independence, then we wouldn't have to worry about what the North was going to do with the blacks if they won the war. And once again, he was a prophet, because we know that after the war, during redestruction that they call reconstruction, but during redestruction, they armed the blacks to turn against the white Southerners. And it created hatred and animosity between the two races, which was exactly what the radical Republicans wanted. They didn't want the blacks to vote the same as their white neighbors because they'd vote Democrat, and that would put them out of power. So they wanted hatred and animosity between the whites and blacks so that the blacks would always stay with the radical Republican army or corrupt administration, and the Southern whites would always be the Democrats and always at each other's throats. And it created hatred because the blacks were collaborators with the enemy. They wore the blue uniform in Reconstruction. They were the ones that were robbing the Southern homes and attacking the women. So that was what the radical Republicans wanted. They wanted that hatred between the races. So anyway, that's what Patrick Cleburne was trying to get rid of. But that idea bombed, and it wasn't thought of, you know, in Richmond. And some of the other officers told him, don't ever bring that up again. And it pretty much killed his career. He was without doubt the best infantry commander in the Army, but he never got above the division level. He should have been at least a corps commander and have two or three divisions under him. Or even after Bragg resigned, put him in charge of the Army of Tennessee. Didn't happen, and we'll finish up the last year of the war and tell you what happened to General Patrick Cleburne at Franklin, Tennessee.
I'd be glad to hear that myself. I'm looking forward to it. Be right back, folks.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, if there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people, unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, we're about to hear a sad story here, and I've often wondered, I'll just tell what I was telling Gene, I don't know why the commanders, the one Major General Cleburne and General Forrest there, I don't know why they didn't overthrow Hood. Must have been kind of mentally ill or something. But anyway, I guess I shouldn't be going down that rabbit trail, but go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Okay, so we talked about what happened at the battle at Missionary Ridge and Ringo Gap. Oh, this is one thing that always ticks me off. The north, they have, it's not a great big battlefield up and down Missionary Ridge. There are little areas like four or five people's yards between houses, you know, about that size. Because, I mean, the ridge is real steep. There's not much you can do on either side of the slope. So it's where the main road runs up and down Missionary Ridge. They have little parks there. But the northern end is pretty much unoccupied. And that's where Cleburne's division was. That's where they beat Sherman like a drum all day long. And I think that's where Sherman came up with that, quote, war is hell. But when you go there today, the northern end of Missionary Ridge is named the Sherman Reservation. And I'm going, are you kidding me? He never got up here. Why didn't they call it the Cleburne Reservation? But that's the U.S. government for you. So anyway, yep. More propaganda. So anyway,
DEI.
Yeah. So we talked about what happened at Dalton, Georgia, and Claiborne's suggestion to arm the slaves and make soldiers out of them that, well, didn't went nowhere, and pretty much locked him in as just a major general and a division commander. He never got the promotions that he should have had, and never got a chance to be commander of the entire Army of Tennessee. So in May of 64, then, we began what was known as the Atlanta Campaign, fighting up and down the Western and Atlantic Railroad between Chattanooga and Atlanta. And Claiborne's division was in it from the get-go. I mean, they fought at Resaca at Kennesaw Mountain, where once again Sherman was hammered by the Confederates when he thought he was just going to zip over the mountain and march right into Atlanta. Once again, he ran into Claiborne's division. Claiborne's division fought in the battles around Atlanta and then Jonesboro. And then, of course, the Atlanta was lost. Well, what had happened, Joe Johnston had retreated all the way down to Atlanta and keeping Sherman at bay and fighting these battles and winning these battles. But Sherman had an army of over 100,000. And the best that Johnston could come up with, everybody on crutches or in wheelchairs or anybody they could put out there, was about 60,000. And Sherman could threaten Johnston at one position and then take an entire corps of out of his army and swing around to the flank and threaten to cut Johnston off, come in behind Johnston and the Confederate Army and cut the railroad, which meant they would be trapped with no supplies and no way to get out of there. So Johnston fought a defensive battle, protecting his army and protecting the railroad behind him until he got all the way down to Atlanta. And President Davis wanted to know, are you going to defend Atlanta or are you going to abandon it? And Johnston never would tell him what he was going to do. So Davis got tired of asking him and relieved him of command and put one of his corps commanders, John Bell Hood, in command of the Army of Tennessee. Well, Hood had a reputation as a fighting, attacking general, and he lived up to his reputation. He launched three major attacks against Sherman's army, the Battle of Peachtree Creek, Ezra Church, and the Battle of Atlanta itself, which is out toward Decatur, and really hammered Sherman's army. But Hood took even worse losses and wound up, Sherman was still able to swing around Atlanta towards Jonesboro. And once he won that battle down there, then Atlanta was cut off from any kind of supplies except for one railroad. So that's when Hood decided to abandon the city of Atlanta that Sherman had been fighting for about 4 months there, and take his army back up north toward Tennessee and pull Sherman up out of Georgia. And Sherman only followed him up about halfway to Chattanooga, and he said, the heck with this. We're going to lose everything we've gained all summer. He turns around, goes back to Atlanta, orders the civilians out, and sets fire to the town of Atlanta and burns it down. And then Sherman heads off, going toward the Savannah and the ocean, the infamous March to the Sea. So this was an unusual situation. You had two major armies, one Confederate army, one Union army, that turned around and marched in opposite directions away from each other. Sherman is just going east towards the Savannah and the ocean, and Hood is going northwest, thinking he can get into Tennessee and maybe recapture Nashville and affect the presidential election that was coming up in November. And if it looked like there was a Confederate army running wild all through Tennessee and maybe up to Louisville or even threatening Cincinnati, Lincoln would probably lose the election. But Hood mismanaged the campaign and forgot all about getting across the Tennessee River and had to wait about 2 or 3 weeks for pontoons to get there to lay a pontoon bridge across the Tennessee River at Florence. That put him behind. And I read a historian said that Hood would, in order to pull this thing off, he would have to have excellent strategy and good luck, and he had neither. And so his army is coming back into Middle Tennessee to try to recapture Nashville and possibly affect the presidential election. But one snafu after another, of course, that night at Spring Hill on November 29th, Hood's army was there at the side of the road, and they pretty much let the Federal Army just tiptoe by them that night at Spring Hill. Orders were confusing. Hood wasn't on the field to make sure that the road was closed. Forrest Cavalry had got swung around behind Schofield, gotten ahead of him up at Thompson Station, which is north of the little town of Spring Hill, and actually stopped the Federal Army, but they ran out of ammunition. and they had Hood had kept up with the supply lines to rearm forest troopers, so they were forced off the road. And Schofield, as we said, got past them that night and came dragging into the town of Franklin the next morning, or marched all night and pretty much collapsed on the streets in Franklin. And then here came Hood after him. And so on the afternoon of November 30th, Hood decides that he's on the hill south of Franklin, and he's going to launch an attack, a frontal attack, across 2 miles of open ground against an enemy that's entrenched. And these are earthworks, called breastworks, because they were breast high or chest high. And, you know, they weren't hiding behind a little rock wall or a picket fence or anything. These are well-prepared earthworks that had been built a year before during that Tullahoma campaign and never used. And now they were, the Yankees were reinforcing the earthworks, had plenty of artillery. So at 1 o'clock that afternoon, Hood called a conference with his officers. It was Frank Cheatham, Patrick Claiborne, Bedford Forrest, and a couple of other division commanders, and explained his plan. And they all said, pretty much, are you crazy? This is suicide. We've got to cross 2 miles of open ground, face artillery, and try to drive an enemy out of well-prepared earthworks. And Forrest told him, you give me one division of infantry, we'll swing around behind him. And he said, this time we'll put the cork in the bottle. Because Forrest was the only officer that had been there on that field. Because he was operating through Middle Tennessee in 1863, and he knew all the roads around there and how he could swing around and go up to Hollow Tree Gap, which even today the road twists and turns going up over those hills between Franklin and Nashville. So Forrest knew where that was, put an infantry division there, his cavalry on the flanks, and they would have Schofield trapped. But Hood wouldn't do it. Launched the frontal attack at 4 o'clock that afternoon. The Confederate Army came forward, hit the Federal lines about 5 o'clock. One of the few major battles in the war that was fought in the dark, because November 30th, it gets dark, and most of the fighting went on at night, and that's why it was so brutal and so many casualties. The Confederates didn't know how many of their fellow soldiers were being slaughtered in front of those trenches, not until the next morning. The next morning came, and they found the body of Patrick Claiborne. He had been shot and killed the night before, or the day before. Okay. He was riding in on his horse. The horse was wounded. He gave his horse to one of his staff officers. The staff officer gave him his horse to ride on with the division so he could move back and forth and direct the division, the different brigades in the division. On horseback, he could go a lot faster than walking. When he put his foot up in the stirrup of that second horse, an artillery shell hit that horse and literally blew the horse out from under him. And he said, well, we're not going to lose any more horses, so he's going in on foot. So that put him down on the same level as his infantry, and he got about, within about 50 or 60 yards of the Carter House cotton gin, which is one of the landmarks on the battle, and Claiborne's division was right in front of the cotton gin, and some of them did make it over the works and broke the Federal lines, but the reinforcements drove them back. But about 50 yards in front of that cotton gin, bullet went right through his chest and killed him on the field. They found the body the next day. They took him down to St. John's Church near Columbia, Tennessee, because when they'd come through there 2 days before, he was looking at this church, and it reminded him of some of the churches in Ireland where he'd grown up. And he said, it's almost worth dying to be buried in such a beautiful location. And little did he know that 2 days later he was going to be buried in that location. His body was reinterred after the war and taken back to a cemetery up on a high hill out just outside of Helena, Arkansas. And they said that after the war, boats traveling up and down the Mississippi River could see that hill and could see the monument that was placed there in honor of General Claiborne. And the former Confederate soldiers would always walk to that side of the steamboat and take their hats off when it passed that hill and the Claiborne monument, because all the Confederates had so much respect for Patrick Claiborne. So that is the important birthday in March, and not March the 2nd, but March the 16th, 1828, the birthday of Confederate Irish General Patrick Claiborne.
Wow, isn't it on a sad note? That's to the bitter end, and we're about out of time. Why Forrest and Claiborne didn't just tell Hood, you've got a mental illness, and just relieve him and take the consequences with Jefferson Davis. They would have saved the army. Well, folks, we're completely out of time. Gene, you did a marvelous job. I've really thoroughly enjoyed listening to that and getting this education. And people, next week will be the 22nd of March, and God willing, we'll be here same place, same time. So don't go anywhere. Be here next week or be square. Good night, everybody.